Good morning. Thanks for coming out on such a cold morning. Can everyone hear me okay? Good. Well, my thermometer said minus 11 this morning, and I hear it's going to get worse, so it is definitely time to bundle up. So this morning, I'm going to continue with the very sporadic series of lectures I've been doing over the years on the Gateless Barrier, which is a compilation of koans by Wu Men. And for these talks, I'm heavily indebted to Robert Aitken. I like his translations and his commentaries, and to a lesser extent to Katsuki Sakita, who wrote Two Zen Classics, or rather translated it, Two Zen Classics, The Gateless Gate and the Blue Cliff Records. Aitken's book is called The Gateless Barrier. So today we're talking about Case 40, and I'm going to start by reading it. It's on your program. If you have a program, you can follow along. When Gui Shan was with Pai Chung's assembly, he was cook of the monastery. Pai Chung wanted to choose a founding teacher for Mount Ta Gui. He invited all his monks to make a presentation, saying, "The outstanding one will be sent." Then he took a water bottle and set it on the floor and said, "Don't call this a water bottle. What would you call it?" The head monk said, "It can't be called a wooden clog." Pai Chung then asked Gui Shan his opinion. Gui Shan kicked over the water bottle and walked out. Pai Chung laughed and said, "The head monk loses." Gui Shan thereupon was made the founding teacher at Mount Ta Gui. So a little background. Let's talk about the cast of characters here. So Pai Chung, he lived 720 to 814. So he was an abbot during the Tang Dynasty in China, during the Golden Age of Zen. And he was important in the development of Chan Buddhism. It was Chan in China, and it became Zen in Japan. He set up rules for monks' daily practice. Until this time, Zen monks had kind of been guests in temples of other sects, and they didn't really have their own places or their own order. So he helped to set that up. And he also was instrumental in making a transition where monks, instead of making their living by begging, would raise crops, raise food at their monasteries, so they were more self-sufficient. And you may have heard about Pai Chung in connection with a story of how when he was really old, some of his students hid his tools from him and because they didn't think he should have to go out and work. And he said, and then he refused to eat. He said, "A day without work is a day without eating." And I kind of like that story because it emphasizes the importance of working in Zen. But I kind of don't like that story because sometimes people are not able to work for various reasons, who knows what, and they still deserve to eat. But anyway, so Pai Chung, I think we can say, is a skilled administrator, but he's also known for his deep insight, and he appears in various koans. So Gui Shan is his student. He was born in 770, lived to 853, so his teacher is 50 years older than him. Gui Shan became a monk at 15, and he started studying with Pai Chung when he was 24. There is an enlightenment story for Gui Shan. And so this incident, this enlightenment incident, happened long before the koan that's the subject of my talk today. But let me tell you what that's about. That's pretty interesting. So one late evening, Gui Shan is sitting up in the dark. He's alone meditating in the dark. And he was accosted by Pai Chung. And Pai Chung says, "Who's sitting here in the dark?" And Guishan says, "It's Ling Yu, master." That was Guishan's name at the time, Ling Yu. And Pai Chung says, "Rake hearth." And Guishan arises, he goes over to the hearth, and he searches for live coals, and he can't find any. And he says, "The fire has gone out." Pai Chung then took up the tongs, and deep in the ashes, he found a small live ember. And holding it up, he said, "What is this?" And with that, Guishan could acknowledge the live coal of his own nature and was deeply enlightened. So Guishan thought that there was no fire, and Pai Chung showed him the ember. Is that something about Buddha nature? Well, I think it might be. Something about Buddha nature being there all along. So the third character is the head monk, and he's kind of the fall guy in this story. And he remains nameless. We don't know very much about him from this koan. So let's go through this koan line by line. When Guishan was with Pai Chung's assembly, he was cook of the monastery. So at this time, Guishan is 47 years old or so. He's been studying with Pai Chung for 32 years. He has risen to the rank of cook, which is a very important position in Zen monasteries. Pai Chung wanted to choose a founding teacher for Mount Ta Gui. So there's kind of a backstory here as to why it is that he wanted to choose a teacher. There was this itinerant monk who was a friend of Pai Chung's, and he shows up at Pai Chung's monastery and he says, "Hey, I have found a really great place to establish a new monastery, and I think you should send somebody to do that." And Pai Chung says, "Great, great, but who should we send?" He says, "How about me?" And the itinerant monk says, "No, not you. You're not strong enough. We need someone younger and stronger." And just then, the head monk came in, and Pai Chung says, "How about him?" And the itinerant monk turns to the head monk, and he says, "Cough." And the head monk coughs. And then he says to the head monk, "Walk around a little bit." So the head monk walks around a little bit. "Not qualified," the itinerant monk says. So this is a strange job interview. Yeah. Probably the itinerant monk was really good at sizing people up. And he could tell just by the way he moved around kind of what the state of his practice was. That's what we hope. That would be the best case scenario. Worst case scenario, the itinerant monk is in a bad mood that day and he's just being kind of arbitrary, which would be pretty unfair. So then Pai Chung sent for Guishan, and as soon as he saw him, the itinerant monk says, "Here is the man for Mount Ta Gui." So he could tell from looking at him he was ready. And remember, Guishan had already become enlightened years before. So probably that was apparent. So then Pai Chung announced to the assembly after a while that Guishan was going to get the job. And the head monk protested and he said, "It should be me." So then in order to keep the peace and keep matters clear, Pai Chung arranged this contest. So, Pai Chung is good at administration, and I think he's giving the head monk a chance to be heard in order to preserve the peace. He knows he has to go through some things here. So, next, he invited all his monks to make a presentation saying, "The outstanding one will be sent." And maybe in the context of that place and that time, this seemed like a skillful way to choose someone to go and do something important. But I'm glad we don't do this kind of thing anymore. It's kind of asking, who can be the most Zen in the moment? And I think that puts a lot of pressure on the moment. And also, it really gives the teacher the power to make very subjective determinations. And those determinations really have a place in the history of Zen. It takes a deeply realized Zen teacher to recognize when another person is deeply realized. Still, it's a chance for a really subjective decision, and I think in order for us to have really fairness, we should minimize those kinds of situations. But it makes a good story. Then he took a water bottle and set it on the floor and said, "Don't call this a water bottle. What would you call it?" Well, the water bottle is an essential part of the monk's gear. They carry it around with them, the same way folks do now, I guess. But it could have been anything. It could have been a bag of rice, and he could have said, "Don't call it a bag of rice. What would you call it?" So he says, "Don't call it a water pot, a water bottle." In a practical sense, of course, it is a water bottle. But what he's acknowledging here is that naming objects is arbitrary in a way. And if you've been practicing for some time, you're probably quite familiar with this idea. The bottle is made up of non-bottle elements, the same way that this cup is made up of non-cup elements. It's made up of sand and glaze, and the process that made the sand, the geological processes, and the human processes that made the glaze, and the people who made the cup, and the people who helped those people to live, and me, because I drink out of the cup, and you, because you're seeing the cup. So on one level, it's a cup, and that's a practical designation. But on another level, you really can't call it a cup because it does not exist independent of those other things. And furthermore, I think the definition breaks down if you look at it really deeply. If you try to pinpoint exactly when it became a cup, you know that's a little arbitrary. Was that when it dried so that it was all ready to drink out of? Or was it before that when the clay was still wet but it was in the form of a cup? Or was it before that when it existed only in the potter's mind? Or was it before that several generations before the potter's parents were born? And when does it cease to be a cup? Well, you could say maybe when it's broken. What if it gets sort of half broken, but I can still drink out of it? What if it gets broken into many little pieces, but one of the pieces is still capable of holding a little water, and I'm able to dip it in to the lake and take a little drink out of it? Is it still a cup? Every name we give to something is arbitrary, and calling it a cup is separating it from things it depends on. And to see it really deeply, we can't do that. So Pai Chung is challenging his students to demonstrate that they recognize this deeper, interconnected nature. So the head monk goes first. The head monk said, "It can't be called a wooden clog." Well, is that a good answer? He's basically saying, well, we can't call it a shoe. Some translations say stump, but again, that doesn't really matter. When asked to say what you can call it, he says what you can't call it. To me, that seems a little evasive. And is he right? He says you can't call it a shoe. But to me, given the arbitrariness of our distinctions, it kind of is a shoe. It kind of is a shoe as much as it is a water bottle. So I wonder, is the head monk really incapable of accepting Pai Chung's invitation to demonstrate that he sees the interconnectedness of things? You know, is he staying here in the world of forms of the practical and saying in a really dogged way, well, maybe you can't call it a water bottle, but you sure can't call it a shoe or wear it as a shoe? So under this interpretation, he's really kind of demonstrating ignorance. He's refusing to go there and saying it could be anything other than the cup. On the other hand, and this is probably kind of a stretch, but we want to give him his due, maybe the head monk knows all about interconnection, and he's making a joke. Maybe he's two steps ahead of Pai Chung. Maybe Pai Chung is asking please show me that you know this water bottle isn't a water bottle. And maybe the head monk is saying, I know it isn't a water bottle, but I also know it is a water bottle. And there are koans in which that might be the right answer. And this is a little bit like this famous story of a debate between Sung San and Kelu Rinpoche, which I've talked about before. So these two great teachers get together for a debate. Sung San opens the debate, reaching into his robe and removing an orange. And he holds it up in a rather theatrical manner and says, what is it? And the elderly lama just kind of sits there fingering his prayer beads. He doesn't say anything. And Sung San comes back and he says, what is it? And finally, Kelu Rinpoche whispers to his translator, and then the translator says, Rinpoche wants to know, what's the matter with this guy? Hasn't he ever seen an orange before? So, maybe the head monk is two steps ahead. Sometimes an orange is just an orange. But Pai Chung thinks he's zero steps ahead, and I doubt that he's two steps ahead because he's kind of the fall guy here, and he seems a little too eager to get this job, so I don't know. But in any case, I think the head monk's answer is deficient because it smacks of thinking. I can just imagine the head monk giving into the temptation to try to think out an answer to this problem, which we all do usually. We try to think of something rather than responding from the depth of our being. And he's thinking, well, I can't call it a water bottle, and I don't know what to call it. I know, I'll say what it isn't. That's kind of mysterious. That sounds pretty zen. That could work. Aitken says his answer demonstrates that he is still bound by the binary computer of the human cortex. This is not that. Male is not female. Birth is not death. The sage is not an ordinary person. So he's kind of caught in this world of distinctions, but Pai Chung is asking him to dig deeper than that. So when I say dig deeper, that he should dig deeper in looking at this water bottle, what do I mean? Well, for one thing, if you dig deeper, I think it's more spontaneous and maybe even more childlike. And Aitken addresses this in his commentary, and I found this really amusing. He wants to pose this same kind of question to a child. So he says, when our son was about 6 years old, I asked him, suppose you couldn't say that your name is Tom. How would you call yourself? He said, that's a very hard question. And Aitken says, this is a better answer than the head monk's. And then he goes on to say, when I told this story in the early days of the Maui Zendo, one of the members went home and asked his 5-year-old son, if you weren't Misha, what would you be? Misha said, a tree. That's a pretty good answer, too. Well, I was able to give this a try myself because on Thursday I was with my 4-year-old grandson. And so I asked him, if you weren't Oscar, who would you be? And right away, with no reflection whatsoever, he said, this guy. And he was indicating a robot that he was holding that we had just built together. And I thought, that was a pretty good answer, too. That's a pretty good answer. So, Pai Chung then asked Gui Shan his opinion. Gui Shan kicked over the water bottle and walked out. Well, I don't know if there's anything such a thing as a really straightforward koan, but if there is, I think this may be it. That's kind of a classic moment. You just kick over the water bottle. It's a bold, simple gesture. It demonstrates that he's not bound by that binary computer. He's not bound by the question. He's not bound by the format the teacher has set up. He's not trying to intellectualize anything. He's not trying to explain anything. He's not trying to come up with an answer. So, when you ask a question about Zen, what can be more delightful than someone rejecting your premise and instead just making a vivid assertion of life right now. Because all of what we do points to vivid life right now. All of my words, hopefully, point just to that. All of my words that necessarily make distinctions. Teacher and student, thinking and not thinking, cup and not cup, realm of separateness and realm of the interconnected. All of these really tiresome distinctions. I could say that I think I'm trying to make these in the service of no distinctions. But that's not quite it either, because when you say no distinctions, of course, you're making a distinction between distinctions and not distinctions. You simply cannot win using words. You can only upend the thing. You can only reject the premise. You can only kick over the water bottle. You can only look around and see what you see. I see steam rising outside, and I see the bell, and I see a little light on the bell. And this morning, driving in, as the sun was coming up behind me, I saw this incredible reflection of the buildings on the buildings in downtown Minneapolis and all the steam coming from the power plants there. And for a moment, I didn't know what it was. You can only sweep the floor and wash the windows and smell the Windex and live your life. Wake up and smell the Windex. And that's how you and how Guishan can demonstrate your enlightenment. And I'd like to throw out a question. If there are no distinctions, how do we look at this thing called enlightenment? Without thinking that, well, there's non-enlightenment and then there's enlightenment. Without making that distinction, how can we possibly do that? How do we kick over that water bottle? Well, let me go back to Guishan's enlightenment story. There's a little more to it. He saw the burning ember that he hadn't seen before, and somehow that helped him to transcend the world of distinctions. There was something about burning and not burning, fire and not fire, and about seeking what was already there that opened him up to just this. And right after that incident, Pai Chung said something to him. He said, and this is from the Sakita book, he said, "You have reached a crossroads on the journey. When the time comes, you will realize it, just like remembering something you have forgotten. It is not obtained from others. Therefore, when you are enlightened, it is just like when you were not enlightened. No mind, no dharma. If only you have no delusions and no discrimination between the Buddha and the unenlightened, your original nature manifests itself. Now you have attained it, mindfully cultivated." So what really jumped out at me here, and what I had never seen before anywhere, is when you are enlightened, it is just like when you were not enlightened. What a confusing thing to say. What a radical thing to say in Zen. It kicks over the water bottle of Zen enlightenment. Enlightenment and non-enlightenment are exactly the same. Well, how can that be? Well, there's kind of an absurdity in saying that in order for me to be enlightened, things have to be different than they are now. Because how can enlightenment be different from what is here right now? If there's enlightenment, it's this. Well, wait a minute then. That means this is it? This is it right now? This is all I get? This is all I ever get? This? Could I possibly just sit here right now with patience, with infinite patience, and just kind of feel how it is and say, this is it. This is it. And I can just let this be what it is. And there's no more. Oh, wait, I want something more. It's got to be different than this. I'm feeling kind of weird right now, kind of nervous right now. It can't be this. It's got to be something different. No, no, it's not something different. If I become quiet for a moment and I try to feel what's going on, I feel something in my belly. I feel some kind of nervousness there, some excitement, maybe a little fear because I'm in the middle of this Dharma talk. But I don't wait for that to go away before I can become enlightened. It's not like that goes away, this thing that makes me think of sort of this anxiety I've been carrying around my whole life. It's not like that goes away someday and then I will become enlightened. If I'm to be enlightened, it has to be with this thing. It has to be in the very midst of this thing. Which means you, right now, this morning, with all of your imperfections and going through the middle of your imperfect morning, that is enlightenment. You're fully enlightened right now. If only? No, there's no if only. There's no if only. No, it's this. It is this now. And when I contemplate that, it is not easy. It is not easy to contemplate that because everything tells me otherwise. No, this can't be it. This can't be enlightenment now. I cannot fully accept this moment. But when I think of doing that, I hear the heart of the universe cracking open, thusness cracking open, because it takes such love and such acceptance and such an open heart to let that happen. And I think there can't be that enlightenment without that openness of heart. And that is really the heart of my talk. But I'm going to go on a little more here. It's going to be downhill from here, I think. Pai Chung laughed and said, "The head monk loses." Gui Shan thereupon was made the founding teacher at Mount Ta Gui. So I can't help but thinking how badly the head monk must have felt here. He kind of walked into it by complaining about the initial decision, but still, I feel badly for him. And I think we read this story, and we really want to be Gui Shan, and we really don't want to be the head monk. You know, we want to be right. We don't want to be rejected. We want to be respected. Usually in our tradition, we don't assign koans and expect an answer. But still, a teacher may ask an opinion or a student may offer one. And the hope is that there won't be a lot of pressure that will interfere with practice, a pressure to be right. And Aitken addresses this in his commentary. He says in the old days in their Zendo, they would sit in a circle and they would discuss koans. And sometimes he would come up with an answer, and then someone else would come up with a better answer. And he said when that first happened, he would be regretful. And then he would be regretful about his reaction. And then finally he would come to and smile at myself. He said, "I wondered at the time if I'd ever reach the point where I could simply accept a mistake at the moment it happened." And he writes that sometimes his students will feel really bad. He'll kind of send them out of Dokusan and say, "No, that's not right." And they may feel really badly about it. They may brood about it. And he says that's unfortunate. And I'm familiar with this. I can remember one time when Tim was giving a lecture at Hokyoji, and he was telling one of these stories, and sort of the culmination of the story was that the monk drew a circle in the air. And maybe some of you remember that story. I don't remember the whole story. I just remember that was sort of the knocking over the water bottle gesture that monk did. And at some point later in the lecture, Tim kind of asked, what someone should do in response to a question or something like that. And I reached up and I drew a circle in the air with my finger. And he said pretty clearly, wrong. And it really was wrong. It was a terrible answer. Because when the monk did it, it was in a certain context, and it was original, and it came from the heart of his being, and it was spontaneous. And for me, it wasn't any of those things. So I felt a little badly about that, but I didn't dwell on it too much. And since then, I've added it to my incredibly long list of mistakes I've made, which I can use as examples of how not to practice Zen. And I think we all need to make these mistakes. And Aitken tells us that this head monk actually went on to be a great teacher in his own right. So he got there. We all make these mistakes, and I think accepting our imperfections with a little humor is part of the heart cracking open. Wu Men also wrote a comment to this koan. It's not in your program, but I'll read it. Though Guishan was altogether valiant, he could not leap out of Pai Chung's trap. If you scrutinize what happened next, you'll see that he accepted the heavy and rejected the light. How? Look, removing his sweatband, he shouldered an iron yoke. So a cook wears a sweatband, so he took that off, and in deciding to found this monastery, he's shouldering an iron yoke. It is not going to be an easy job. He's accepting the heavy and rejecting the light. But Wu Men's giving us a really different take here. When I read the case, I thought, oh, Guishan gave the right answer, and he's being rewarded with this really great job. But Wu Men says that Pai Chung has set a trap, which he's fallen into. And anyone who's had a major temple office here can probably relate to this, because it's kind of a mixed blessing. Sometimes it's wonderful. It's always good to serve the community, but sometimes it's an iron yoke. And this did become an iron yoke for Guishan. He sat alone on that mountain for a long time, and finally, after 8 years, three monks showed up to help him. And then things took off, and he got imperial support, and eventually that monastery held 1,500 disciples. But in saying that Guishan was caught in Pai Chung's trap, is Wu Men leaving for a moment the realm where Zen is a constant kicking over of the water bottle? And is he bringing us back to the world where an orange is just an orange, and there are winners and losers, and the practical administration of the temple? I think so. And it's interesting to look at koans this way, kind of critically, with a view of kind of who holds the power. And I don't think they were intended that way, but I think this is instructive. And I think here in the real world, we can't always say, sort of stay in that realm of absolute and say, well, he kicked over the water bottle and that's what we do. We also have to pay attention to those relationships and whether things are fair. Excuse me. And I think that's something worth talking about. So Wu Men wrote a verse to, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he swept all impediments before him. Pai Chung's severe barrier cannot interrupt his rush. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from his toes. So he gave up his kitchen implements. He went past all impediments. Nothing could stop him, not the challenging job. And this seems like straightforward praise for Guishan's devotion to the Dharma and his energy and his willingness to help. Thousands of Buddhas came forth from his toes. That's kind of a weird, nice image about how our actions can have wonderful effects even beyond our imagination. Sakita says that it means that he produced many distinguished Zen teachers, and I think it's a nice way to end. I think that that's kind of a nice antidote for the part of us that gets a little worried about how we're going to be perceived or how we're going to perform. We can remind ourselves that this is about the Dharma. This is about living the Dharma and sharing the Dharma. It's about what we do for others. So even our own mistakes we can bear with good humor. Even our own mistakes are helpful. They help us and they help others. And we gotta make them. We can't learn without making them. So if you're new here, it may seem sometimes that we're a little austere, or we have all of this stuff we do and all of this stuff we know that makes us kind of an in-crowd that's hard to crack or something. And that can be a little daunting. But I think if you stick around, you will find that there's an easier side to all of this. And we know that we're all in this together. We know that we make mistakes. We're a very forgiving group, and it's a forgiving practice. And we can approach this practice with some lightness and forgiveness for ourselves and for others. And and that's what I would like to, what I have to say today. And if anyone has a comment or a question, I'm certainly open to hearing from you. Yes, Benton, in the hallway.
So you said you have this collection of mistakes that you have of examples of how not to practice.
Yes.
Is that exactly the way to practice?
Well, there you go. Yes. Did everyone hear that? Ted, you said you have this collection of mistakes that can help people to practice, but isn't that exactly the way to practice? He's right. What can I say? Yes.
So when you were talking about enlightenment and non-enlightenment being two things you can't distinguish, but they're the same?
Yes.
It's confusing to me too. And then, but then you sort of said that maybe the heart being more open. So I think you kind of broke what you were saying in trying to define enlightenment with it's more open than less.
I did.
More open heart than less open heart, which makes sense to me. I think you're right, but then that kind of breaks what you said.
It did. I contradicted myself. And I think when I say that enlightenment and non-enlightenment are just the same, we can't take that too literally, or we can't think about it too much. It's kind of a provocative thing to say that challenges our ideas about enlightenment. Because we get this idea that enlightenment is something special and different, and so we're looking outside of ourselves or into the future for something different from this. And then we can't see this. It takes us outside of ourselves. So by saying this provocative thing, I'm trying to help us to come back to right here. It's just this. Forget any idea about enlightenment. Forget about being different. It's just this right now in your imperfect state. But at the same time, on another level, there are ways in which, you know, being awake and not being awake are different. And there is... there are reasons to talk about it that way. The same way as, you know, in one sense, this isn't a cup, but it's very helpful for me to talk about it as a cup. So, yes, I definitely contradicted myself. We do that a lot in Zen. Zen is not a logical thing, and it has to do with two things which seem to our logical minds to be opposite, being true at the same time. So I've probably added to the confusion.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes.
So I was thinking about koans, and I was wondering, it seems like in the Zen culture, at least that I'm sitting in right now, that people don't like using them as much in a serious way to judge people, like what you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here's your koan, your response is dumbly, you know, rather than like, you want to say, oh, that's a good response. But is that like a, Is that because we're in Minnesota? Kind of like Minnesota. We don't want to be like, here's the coin. Got it wrong. Go eat.
Yeah.
Is that why we're talking like that, or is it just because is it internationally Zen Buddhists are not as like badass and
part of it? Yeah, that is a great question. Part of it is that we're in Minnesota. Part of it's our tradition. In Rinzai Zen, there's a tradition of assigning koans, and you pass the koan or not. Your teacher decides whether you demonstrated an understanding of the koan. And we just don't do that in Soto Zen very much. Usually we just kind of talk about these koans. So part of it's our tradition. But I do think that here in our temple, we're pretty nice. In Minnesota, we're pretty nice, and we tend to take a more gentle approach here, I think, than they do in some Zen centers. I mean, certainly there are harsh aspects of Zen. Traditional Japanese Zen practice is very, very tough. And I think here the attitude of many of us is, you know, the practice is hard enough. If you're going to sit there and face the wall most of the time for 7 days, that's hard enough. We don't have to add to it by being sort of harsh and judgmental too. Also, different teachers have different styles, and some get really sort of fed up with the niceness and want to just be direct, and that's great. And if you resonate with that kind of teaching, you can find that kind of teacher. And if you want someone who's going to be really nice most of the time, you can find you can come to me. And you know, there's probably a downside. Maybe I should say, no, you're wrong. You know, but I think you'll get it. I like that gentle approach. So, long wandering answer.
Yeah,
Charlie.
Sometimes we want to think of enlightenment as a destination, but really, it's a journey, and we never get to the end of the journey. Is that one way of?
Yes, it is. Yes, very much. Very good. Yeah, and
okay. I'm reading a book called The Talent Code. I don't know if anyone...
The Talent Code.
Very cool. So the section I'm on right now is called Deep Practice. The basic question that the author poses is, where does genius come from? And why does it tend to show up in all these odd places, genius however it's presented? So it gets into neurobiology quite a bit, and it deals with myelin, which is the sheathing that goes along neurons. So once you get a message from one neuron, automatically a little bit of myelin, which is this fatty substance, coats the neuron and creates this protection. And the more you excite that particular circuit, the more myelin is laid down. This is where the 10,000 hours comes down. So you lay this down for 10,000 hours and you have something very, very strong. What they found out is that if you challenge the circuit by creating problems, that you're wiring automatically, the DNA says, we've got to send out a whole lot more of this myelin. So if you want really deep learning, you present a problem, and the response is so much stronger than if you do something easy. It's just kind of da-da-da-da-da. Ah. Robot.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And one more.
This was hard for me to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself, my head and my, I was thinking through the logic. I was planning on challenging all these things that you were saying. And it felt, there was a lot of friction, and I felt a lot of friction. And I was trying to feel what my heart was feeling. And what I really wanted to do was walk out. Would you have been impressed with that? Do you think he kicked over the water bottle out of frustration?
No, I don't think it was frustration. I mean, it could have been. We could probably imagine a scenario like that. But if you had walked out, I probably would have thought, gee, I guess he didn't like my talk, you know, and I would have been a little sad. I may not have seen the eloquent commentary of it. But I'm glad you stayed.
Yeah, just thinking in, you know, in board meetings and at work, and we always come from our head.
Mm-hmm.
And if we, you know, if we're asked to comment on a certain graph and make a prediction, if we just hit the delete button and walk out, or flap our wings and jump out the window, people are going to think we're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're probably going to get fired.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of getting promoted.
Right, right.
So I'm having trouble identifying with this and connecting with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the corporate world, doing something radical like that, sort of rejecting the premise of the meeting or the question, is probably going to get you thrown out, except in a few rare instances. And here, but I think in the Zen world, we really value that, and this is a place to really explore that other side of our natures, where we constantly challenge that thinking function by looking a lot deeper. We still value that thinking function, and we know those meetings are worthwhile, and the graphs are worthwhile. It's great to comment on them. We just sort of try to avoid the trap of thinking that that is what all of life is.
And it breaks my heart that I have to live one life in here, mm-hmm. and then I have to go out and live another life.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, the biggest challenge that most of us have, but you can bring this life to out there, and you can bring that life in here, and you can bring them together and find your genuine self out there. It is not easy, but I think it can be done.